The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to part two of the Partially Examined Life, episode 129 on faith, featuring guests Pastor Rob Dyer and Professor Nathan Gilmore. In part one, we had gotten through the short articles by Antony Flew, that was The Presumption of Atheism, and Norwood Russell Hansen, that is The Agnostic's Dilemma, Stephen Kahn's The Irrelevance of Proved Religion. We also talked about Merrill Westfall's Sin and Reason, and we touched on Robert N. Adams' The Sin of Unbelief. So in the second half, I think we're going to talk more about Peter Van Inwagen's Clifford's Principle, the article by Richard Swinburne, The Voluntariness of Faith, Basil Mitchell's Faith and Criticism, Paul Helm's Faith and Merit, and especially, probably our most important figure of the second half is Alvin Plantinga in his article, Is Belief in God Properly Basic? Now let me remind you where we left off, which was with the overall theme of the podcast, is religious belief rational? Which of course means we have to figure out, to some degree, what rational amounts to. Some of the authors we've discussed so far equated rationality with following the evidence. Seems harmless enough, but if evidence means empirical evidence, then think back to your Immanuel Kant. That would only apply to empirical matters, and not, for instance, to the existence of a God which lives outside space or time, or to your aesthetic preference among narratives, as our guest Nathan has described it. So if rationality doesn't mean proof, maybe you could argue for atheism or theism just on moral grounds, on aesthetic grounds, on psychological grounds. All right, here goes.
One approach to all of this is just to say, look, it just doesn't matter to me whether belief in God is rational. I think that's fideism.
I guess I have become so postmodern, which is to say insufferable enough, that a whole lot of the intellectual world looks like fideism to me, even where it doesn't look like it to other folks.
So fideism was, like evidentialism, seemingly a word that does not need to exist. It's like evidentialism is just belief in evidence, and fideism is a belief in faith. Right?
No, fideism means that belief in God isn't really, it doesn't matter whether it's rational or not.
Right. So it's advocacy of faith. That's
it's important that faith not be in conflict with reason, right? For some people that's actually important, and that's we sort of presume the importance of that
okay.
with this podcast. But for some people, it's, you know, including presumably Kierkegaard, for instance, it's just not important at all whether faith and reason are in conflict. You choose faith anyway.
So. Was it Tertullian, Nathan, that says, I believe it because it's irrational, because it's...
Yes, that is Tertullian.
I hope he said it with that accent, too, because that was quite... quite awesome.
I think I wrongly attributed that to Augustine in some past podcast, and I feel ashamed of myself.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's definitely Tertullian. And I guess, again, you know, the strong distinction between faith and reason, like I said, first of all, strikes me as stacking the deck right from the outset, simply because, I mean, I see a lot of what goes on in systematic theology, for instance, as very rational. You know, it has syllogistic connections between its elements. It relies on a certain kind of logical coherence in order to work. So yeah, I mean, I don't know that I would say that rationality is unimportant. I would want to think a little bit longer about what range of things counts as rationality.
Why, that sounds like you're bringing us to Basil Mitchell's Faith and Criticism from 1994.
Well,
which both he and Van Inwagen, who is a couple articles later, rip on this guy W.K. Clifford and his principle, it is wrong always, everywhere, and for everyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence.
Yeah, Clifford's getting a beat down in these later articles.
So we've talked a lot about that, and you know, one of the responses which Van Inwagen also goes is that they're sort of individual, things that can strike an individual. Basil Mitchell, basically, his whole article is quoting John Henry Newman, which I guess, Nathan, I've heard that name mentioned on your podcast. Is he one of your central figures?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the name is familiar, but I was not
he's never been on our list of potential people to read. But apparently he was known for, he's 1800 something, for criticizing Locke. The way he puts it in here is, Locke the empiricist. Newman says that Locke consults his own ideal of how the mind ought to act instead of investigating human nature as it is actually found in the world.
Right. So, I mean, in that way, I think Newman is a proto-Wittgensteinian because he's interested in saying, okay, how is it when we think that we actually think? What is it that counts as this matching that? What is it that counts as evidence in this particular narrative? What is it that counts as evidence in that particular narrative? But to summarize Mitchell a little bit, really his central question is, does anyone actually think that way? Do we go around in our human interactions with the world, whether that be with our neighbors or with the natural world, or for those who believe with various faces of God, thinking, okay, you know, you, my child, I'm waiting for the evidence to come along that you're not, in fact, my child. That's not really the way that human nature works. And that's where he quotes Newman criticizing Locke, that we ought to take a look at the way that human thought processes actually happen. And what Mitchell focuses on, and this is over in page 365, is that the great criticism of theological thinking is its tenacity. So in other words, when someone produces evidence against the existence of God, believers tend to be tenacious in their belief in God and try to basically do an end run around the apparent lack of evidence or the apparent evidence to the contrary.
Right, the problem of evil, yep.
Yeah, to create an alternative theory that accounts for the new phenomenon but still keeps the core of what they believe. And what Mitchell wants to propose, I think, and this is over on 366, is that when you look at the actual operations of normal science. And did you all do a Thomas Kuhn episode?
We did.
Oh,
good, yep. good. All right. So if you're looking at the operations.
Game drop away.
If you're looking at the operations of normal science, the way that we actually encounter anomalous phenomena when we observe material happenings, what we tend to do is not to say that, therefore, physics is bunk, but we say, how can we account for it using the physical categories that we have? And then you get into what Kuhn calls the possibility of a scientific revolution and a supplanting of one paradigm with another, which it is something that certainly involves logic, but it also involves sociological realities, historical realities, psychological realities, all kinds of good stuff beyond simple observation and pattern recognition and theory generation. So Mitchell wants to ask, if scientists are allowed to be tenacious about atomic theory, couldn't Christians be tenacious about the Trinity?
Good summary. It comes back to this idea that it's not so much even in science that you have this data and then you inductively leap from data to conclusion. You come up with a sort of creative theory which explains some data, and then you put it to the test. You try to disconfirm it, or you see if it has predictive power. You see if new phenomena can be explained by the same theory. But as Kuhn points out, and as Mitchell's is bringing up, in many cases, even if you find a contradiction, you don't immediately abandon the theory. You try to find some way to explain things that preserves the theory. So if you think of God as a theory, you can see the force of that, which is that, well, God has such and such explanatory value and ultimately such and such pragmatic value, and you can't provide me with any direct disconfirming evidence. Mm-hmm. Even in the case of hard problems like the problem of evil, we can have a discussion about that. We can do theodicy. We can justify the ways of God to humanity and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's an interesting parallel.
The other thing that appeals to me about Mitchell here is that he allows for revolutions within a community of inquiry not to be the simple abandonment of a thing, but the radical reformation or revision of the thing. So within physics, when we discover that the atom is not in fact indivisible, we don't abandon the atom as a concept, but rather we reconceptualize it as nucleus plus valence shell. And I think that that is appealing for me because that tells the story of a lot of the revolutions that do occur within Christian communities. It's not necessarily that they instantly go atheist, but their conceptions of God transform based on new experiences, new observations, new arguments, so on and so forth. And Rob, I mean, you know, you're our liberal Protestant here. I mean, you all are kung fu masters at this.
Yes.
Did your congregation slip into Spinozism last year?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're just regular revolutionaries there. What I really appreciated about Mitchell was this not trying to draw a line between faith and reason, but to say that both are subject to the same type of biases. And let's just own the way that we approach issues and understandings. For example, in my former career, one of the things I did was I helped design radios for the Army. And, you know, the different software teams and hardware teams that worked on the radio, you know, when there was some behavior that occurred and we needed to explain it, everybody walked into the room with their bias. Usually it was that you figured, well, my stuff's working perfect, it's your stuff that's broken. And so the hardware guys would say, well, it's obviously the signal processor that's off. And then they would say, well, I think the ASIC is off. And we go back and forth like that. And I think that it's just ridiculous to have this idea that anybody walks into an exercise of philosophy or theology or really any human endeavor without this burden of bias and of cumulative experiences that build up that bias. And then finally, that last part, which I love the way it was phrased, the principle of tenacity, which is not just a stubbornness to be willing to be moved, but it's a necessary grounding. It's a necessary inertia. Otherwise, we would just be all over the place and we couldn't settle on any such thoughts because we'd be subject to every little bit of evidence that seems a bit off. So yeah, I just really appreciated this article in particular for that air of humility, which is kind of my shtick for the evening, it seems.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the accumulation of probabilities. So he has a nice list, Mitchell does, A through D, of sort of what rationality amounts to. And he says, much reasoning is tacit and informal. It is the accumulation of probabilities arising out of the nature and circumstances of the particular case under review. So really, you have to talk about, again, not rationality in the abstract. What would an alien coming to Earth, somebody completely free of any sort of bias, conclude? Because there is no such thing. The way, is it Plantinga? Is that how to pronounce his name?
Oh, goodness.
It is Tanaka.
What do you think? Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that's the way.
He also talks about this as a bottom-up case, not a top-down, that you have individual experiences, which the way he characterizes them, Plantinga characterizes them as, well, I gave one that is you contemplate the starry heavens and you think of the vastness, and this makes you naturally think of, wow, how vast must be the being who created this, or something like that. It makes you think of the vastness. It makes you... Of course, that's not going to be an intuition that somebody like Dawkins shares. I think Dawkins has a whole book on how amazing and awesome nature is and how you can, as an atheist, admit that. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. But Plantinga says, well, you start where you are. I mean, this is what the hermeneutic circle is about. If that's the tradition that you're in, if that's the point of view you're coming at things from, if these ultimate conclusions you come are built out of by something like induction of individual experiences, individual decisions, then you have to look at your actual reactions. You have to do phenomenology, not pay attention to what somebody else is telling you their interpretations of these things are. I mean, those can be, of course, useful, I would hope, to talk with other people and like, what do you think of the night sky? Well, how do you interpret that? Which seemed to be something to me that was missing maybe from Plantinga's case. But in any case, Mitchell seems to think that you can build up to something like the paradigm that you then hold to with the principle of tenacity by these cumulative experiences.
Yeah, and I saw a video on YouTube, an interview with Plantinga, and he gave this one argument saying that, well, without evidence of me having some type of malfunction, if I go through life and as evidence of the world comes at me, I continue to hold on to this belief, then it's reasonable because I don't see a malfunction in myself and others do not observe that in me either. So if I hold on to this belief through all these experiences, then that makes it reasonable. And I'm not so sure how much I really want to jump on the Plantinga train and ride that for a while, but I thought that was a kind of an interesting way to phrase it. Just to give another shout out back to that Will to Believe episode that you had, there was another exchange that y'all had where at some point you're having an argument over why is it that I believe that when I put my pencil down on the table that it's going to stay there and not float up into the air? And the argument that you all were having back and forth was that, is it that I have a belief in the law of gravity? No, it's the cumulative set of experiences that I have had that teaches me to expect that when I put the pencil down on the table, it will not float up into the air. It will stay on the table. I do not think to myself, ah, thank goodness for gravity, you know, for the bending of the space-time continuum by the mass of the planet, for now the pencil will stay on the table. Thus, I believe, here I go. Yeah.
That would be a top-down approach. Yes.
No. But instead, it's very much just like, well, since I've been a kid, every time I put pencils down, they stay down. And if on a given day you were to put down a pencil and it would suddenly start to float upwards, well, okay, now I need to notice that. I need to deal with that. But a lifetime of cumulative experiences sets you up to believe certain things, expect certain things, interpret what happens. That's, you know, you ask a small child about when you're on one of those carnival rides that spins very fast and they try to throw out an item and it comes back against the wall that's spinning. I don't know if you've ever been on one of those before, but a child will say, oh, that's gravity, if they have that knowledge. Or they'll say like, oh, that's like dropping thing. And it's like, no, it's kind of different, but you're trying to just explain it from what you've seen and experienced and know to be true. It's kind of accumulated.
Well, what do you think? I mean, I'll buy the examples that he compares religious belief to. Going back to, if you really took Clifford seriously about you need to have evidence and you need to only believe in proportion to the evidence that's presented to you, then, for instance, how would you know for certain that other minds exist or that somebody is in pain? And the way Plantinga says, you know, it's that instead of it being a problem like Descartes might think, or somebody engaging in a Cartesian project of doubt might think, that don't we think that it's just one of the way Plantinga puts it is that seeing someone in pain naturally gives rise the belief to me that there is a person in pain there. I mean, really, what am I experiencing? I'm not experiencing someone in pain, strictly speaking, if you're just being empirical. I'm experiencing an appearance of somebody writhing around. You know, I'm witnessing some visual thing. But he says it's a mistake to say that you infer from that that someone is in pain. No, it really is a better description of the experience, a better phenomenological description to say one of the basic things that I'm experiencing, it's someone in pain.
Well, I think the important idea here is that we have these beliefs that he calls properly basic, which,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Which means that they are not derived from other beliefs. They're not justified in terms of other beliefs that we have. So for instance, seeing a tree, calling to mind a memory, right? What's the evidence that I really went to the store yesterday? You know, I have it as a memory, but there's no evidence in terms of, you know, I can't rationally justify it in terms of other beliefs. So those sorts of things are basic. And that includes this experience of other people as having minds or being in pain. And he's going to want to include this experience of, or this belief in God as among those sorts of beliefs.
Well, but specifically, it's not directly the belief in God. That would be like the belief in gravity that Rob was talking about. It's these individual instances of the vastness of the universe or how pretty the flower is. And so experiencing it as, just like you experiencing seeing someone writhing around is, now I'm experiencing that person in pain. Plantinga wants to make the comparison that when I see a beautiful flower, I can, at least he does, coming out with his biases, sees it as an immediate evidence of the goodness of God, the well-designedness of nature. And from there, okay, so maybe God exists is not itself properly basic, but it's one little step. It's just a generalization from all these individual things that then, again, build up over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the cumulative aspect of it, too, came up again in the Alston article in trying to deal with mystical experiences that happen in people's lives and saying that part of the tradition, the background theology or aspects of your tradition, or say the background of your own atheism informs how you interpret these added experiences that come into play. And so, you know, we have to constantly rely on other sources in order to interpret what's coming in terms of our experiences as they come into our lives. So I think that in a number of these articles, I like better when Alston took an approach at it and just said, look, that you're going to be biased by the tradition or background that you're exposed to. And I think that that's definitely something that as a practicing clergy, as we encounter more and more people who don't walk through our doors with a grounded, specific narrative of faith or tradition, it becomes harder and harder sometimes for us to communicate what it is that we believe, because a lot of the folks who have spent most of their lives engaged in a community of Christian faith take for granted this background that is at work that is coloring our experiences. And I'm willing to admit, biasing what we take in and what we interpret. So I just feel like that's part of what makes it so difficult to consider these different proofs or arguments without just owning up to these biases that keep coming up in several of these articles.
Right. And to summarize Alston real quick, I mean, his central claim seems to be that mystical experiences always occur in some sort of symbolic narrative matrix. So in other words, the apparition of some sort of entity to a Muslim is not going to be interpreted as the divine Logos, the Son of God, because that is a category that is anathema within Islam. Whereas an apparition to a Hindu is a lot more likely to be Krishna than it is to be Jesus, and so on and so forth. So it's not just what Rob said, but what Rob said is right, that it biases us, but it actually provides the context inside of which a mystical experience can actually be intelligible in the first place. It's the conditions within which we can actually tell the story of a mystical experience.
Well, that's what hermeneutics is all about. We covered Gadamer within the last year. So hermeneutics is about, to understand something new, you have to have some tools. It's not, bias always sounds negative.
Yeah.
Like you want to get rid of bias. You want to be objective. But no, if we didn't have these things from beforehand, we could not make intelligible the new experiences. I think some later episode, we're eventually going to get to reading William James' Variety of Religious Experience, and we'll talk about mysticism more. So I don't want to spend too much time on it now, but I do like the point in the Alston article that you could just call it another kind of experience, another kind of thing that, just like these things that Plantinga is bringing up, that if you just had one in isolation, it might not make, I was going to say, it might not be a conversion experience, but maybe it would be, that you finally get out from the city. So you could actually see the sky, whereas you could not make it out before, and you encounter the vastness and you're overwhelmed and you have a religious conversion right then and there. It is possible that this kind of thing could happen. But the normal criticism of people who have what near-death experiences or claim mystical experiences is, wow, isn't that a coincidence that you happen to see the God that you were expecting to see? And that somebody who's raised in a Hindu culture sees the God they're expecting to see. Isn't that, you know, so that's a way of trying to undermine all mystical experiences. That obviously what was going on there is just some freak biological thing, and you interpreted it according to your preconceived notions. Mm-hmm. And Alston's actually just saying, yeah, that's the way knowledge works. That's not a reason to dismiss it. It just means that, right, in isolation, a mystical experience by itself would not be enough to found a religion all the way. We've heard several echoes of that in this conversation with the Jesus at the foot of the bed and such, that, you know, if you didn't already have not necessarily even just training or culture, but some other experiences that would support this. I don't know. I find it difficult to buy certainly Plantinga's point that having these religion infused experiences. So wait, every day I go out and I look at a flower and I see there's God, there's God, there's God, there's God. And so...
So where in Plantinga is this?
More examples on page 351.
351, yep.
These propositions are properly basic in the right circumstances. The flower is created by God. The vast and intricate universe was created by God. We contemplate the flower or behold the starry heavens. He talks about whenever I feel bad about something. I don't know. Nathan, do you have the quote there about experiences of regret or experiences of other?
Upon reading the Bible, one may be impressed with a deep sense that God is speaking to him. Upon having done what I know is cheap or wrong, I love that phrase, or wicked, I may feel guilty in God's sight and form the belief God disapproves of what I've done. Upon confession and repentance, I may feel forgiven, forming the belief God forgives me for what I've done. A person in grave danger may turn to God, asking for his protection and help. And of course, he or she then forms the belief that God is indeed able to hear and help if he sees fit. When life is sweet and satisfying, a spontaneous sense of gratitude may well up within the soul. Someone in this condition may thank and praise the Lord for his goodness, and will, of course, form the accompanying belief that indeed the Lord is to be thanked and praised. And I agree completely with Mark here. I mean, if you don't have a prior matrix of, I'm going to call it Christian theology, even though it's a little bit imprecise, but if you don't have that system of symbols and narratives and convictions that we call Christianity, then you're not going to have those experiences and thank God for them. At least I don't think so, Rob.
No, I'd say that's true. And I think that some recent writing about understanding what's going on with faith in our common culture speaks to this. Diana Butler Bass has a book, Christianity After Religion, in which mm-hmm. she talks specifically about how it's interesting the way we so often in the past have talked about that people's approach to faith is that, well, first you figure out what you believe, then you start behaving according to those beliefs. And then after you do that a while amongst a community of faith in a church or setting or whatever, you'll finally feel like you belong to this movement or to this particular church. And she pointed out that, like, when you get down to it and you actually talk to human beings and ask them how it really works for them, you find out it's in exactly the opposite order, that we often first feel a sense of belonging, and then we start behaving along with these folks, and then beliefs are created, which I think very much is exactly the situation of the context is set, the experiences are there, you're within a narrative, and then beliefs are formulated. And I think that happens not just in faith communities, I think that happens in other circumstances as well.
Why is belief in the great pumpkin not properly basic as well then?
Ah, well, I think that we have a great answer for that that's given to us right there in our wonderful Plantinga, who says at the bottom of page 354, thus, for example, the Reform epistemologist may concur with Calvin in holding that God has implanted in us a natural tendency to see his hand in the world around us. The same cannot be said for the great pumpkin, my friend Wes, there being no great pumpkin and no natural tendency to accept beliefs about the great pumpkin. So there's some notion here that there has not, in the experience of humankind, been an implanting of a tendency to believe in the great pumpkin.
Yeah, before that, he's talking about how there really is no cut and dried criterion for what's properly basic, right?
It sounds like it's phenomenological. It's the fact that people like me, Alvin Plantinga, are reporting that this kind of stuff seems properly basic to me. And it's just that we don't actually have. If we had examples of a lot of people standing up and saying, well, great pumpkinism actually does seem natural to me, then you would start to pay attention to them. But the fact that we don't have that means we can dismiss it.
Yeah, and I will say that, like, in my own experience of faith, is that the longevity of these ideas, their ability to withstand the rise and fall of cultures and have influence over such a long period of time gives it weight for me. So not just that today I don't look around and see great pumpkinism running wild, it's that over centuries, great pumpkinism has not been able to get any traction. But the very traction that Christianity has had, that moves me. And I think that moves a lot of believers, not simply just that grandma and grandpa believed it, because that doesn't work so well, especially now.
I think the fact that pumpkins are edible is also kind of a drawback.
Sure, absolutely. Well, if you, but we have communion, though, so.
Oh.
Yeah, that does.
Delicious chocolate cheese.
Oh, yeah, this, okay. God's edible, too. I forgot about that. Okay.
Yeah. That's why Plantinga's argument isn't compelling for me, and also why I'm glad there are liberal Protestants like Rob Dyer in the world, is because liberal Protestants tend to be a lot better than evangelicals like me at saying that just because something's been around for a butt-long time doesn't mean that it's good. And, you know, fact of the matter is, I mean, you know, churches like Rob's have been a lot more ready than churches like mine, for instance, to welcome women into all aspects of the life of the community. And that's one of those things that certainly we can have theological disputes about that. But just in terms of the discussion we were just having, if longevity of a concept is a high priority criterion for its goodness, there's a whole lot of stuff that I would call bad that would end up being good.
Yes, and I think, though, what you recognize is that it takes time and it takes a preponderance of evidence to move things in other directions. I would totally agree that longevity is something that it gives me pause, and I think it should give the thoughtful person pause, much in line with that principle of tenacity, that it gives you pause before jumping to something new, and it makes you look at it a bit more carefully. And thanks be to God that we don't just get stuck on the items that we've had for a long period of time, that we are open to things being changed, our understandings being changed, the idea of things that evolve. But I have to say that the overall principle, I mean, just the very basic nature of the idea of a belief in God, which that goes much farther back than any kind of organized religion that decided rules on what type of bits and pieces you had to have in order to be a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before we go any further with that, let's stop for a second and talk about our sponsor, The Great Courses. We are big fans of The Great Courses. We love learning about so many things at our own pace for the pure pleasure of it. And that's why we're excited about something new from The Great Courses. It's The Great Courses Plus Video Learning Service with unlimited access to thousands of fascinating subjects. The Great Courses Plus has nearly 5,000 video lectures in subjects like history, science, photography, cooking, of course, philosophy, and more, taught by award-winning professors and experts from National Geographic, the Smithsonian, and the Culinary Institute of America. With The Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many different lectures as you want at any time from anywhere on your TV, laptop, tablet, or phone. Partially Examined listeners can get a new introductory offer to The Great Courses Plus free for 1 month. The Great Courses lecture series are normally priced at $200 to $300 each, but now you can get unlimited access to the entire Great Courses Plus library completely free for 1 month. So go sign up now for your free 1 month trial. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. Okay. I recall, Nathan, you saying on your podcast early on, I think you had an episode on epistemology and said that for people in a religious community, it's necessary at least to study enough epistemology because it is so often used as a weapon against religious belief. So this Clifford's principle is a great example that you had summed up really all of analytic philosophy as being positivist, which is gross oversimplification.
It is. And Mark, I told you I'm not that careful.
But the idea that you come up with a method and you say, this is the only way that knowledge could be legitimate. Then you apply that to religious belief and you say, well, look, that doesn't work. So therefore we rule out, you know, so that goes back to Hume, you know, it goes back to Locke. It goes other, well, Locke wouldn't have admitted it. Hume at least was straight up that this was what he was trying to do.
Hume was more honest about it.
And just because we get rid of one of these things, we say, hey, Clifford's principle, if you tried to apply it across the board, it would show that actually most of our beliefs are not justified. So therefore, it cannot work. Well, still, the fact that we don't, so that the atheist might say, well, okay, so you give me your epistemological principle to put it in its place. Maybe Plantinga says this. And the response by whichever author this is, no, we don't need that. Just the fact that we don't have a theory doesn't mean we can't know stuff. That we've been knowing things for hundreds of thousands of years without having a theory. You know, and we still are able to look at different beliefs and say, you know, this is more or less justified. We can rule out Great Pumpkinism. We can rule out all sorts of things without having to over-intellectualize it.
It's von Inwagen that says this at the end of his article.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It says, this double standard consists in setting religious belief a test it could not possibly pass and in studiously ignoring the fact that almost none of our beliefs on any subject could possibly pass this test. And it's this Clifford principle.
Well, I knew that part was from Van Inwagen, but is he the one that says, and we don't need a method to replace it. We don't need a principle to replace it. Does this sound familiar, Wes?
No.
Okay, 364. Let's try this in Mitchell. Letter D towards the bottom of the page.
Yep.
What we have said so far following Newman about the ways in which people actually think about what constitutes rationality in ordinary life leads naturally to a fourth consideration which bears more closely on the relevance of faith. If our appreciation of evidence and our assessment of the conclusions that follow from it is generally tacit and implicit, and if the process of reasoning is conducted within a framework of assumptions, which are to some extent influenced by the individual's entire character and personality, a certain stability over time in these assumptions is necessary.
That's a good point. I'm glad you threw in there. It is not the same point that I was trying to make.
But it's not the one you're looking for. Okay.
That's the one that leading up to his sort of comparison to normal science and Kuhn.
Okay, well, I tried.
Well, I think we've gotten most of the bits of these many articles out here. Are there any important points that you guys recall that we haven't talked about yet?
I think Swinburne and this factor of the acting as if as a portion of faith,
yeah,
this pragmatist faith.
So this was a peculiar article. Swinburne actually wrote two articles that we read here, two pieces of things. Swinburne is actually somebody I referred to that I read some of. I read some of this, The Existence of God, I think is the name of the book, and is a very cheery and fun writer. But I found his selections in here to sort of be surprisingly the least useful among the ones we read. Mm-hmm. That the first, The World and Its Order, is a straight up just argument that, yeah, we can accept that evidence is necessary to prove that God exists. And there's plenty of evidence. And, you know, pretty much giving you the teleological argument, the argument from design. Mm-hmm. I feel like we already dealt with that kind of stuff enough in the Arguments for the Existence of God episode. But then this second one, The Voluntariness of Faith from 1981, is the one that Rob just brought up. And it was a little strange to me. Like, it's a little snippet of something, so I wasn't completely clear what he was talking about. But he starts that by talking about the different kinds of faith. And, you know, is it possible to have a pragmatist faith? Well, so go on, and Rob, describe what the point was.
Well, yeah, just to say that, you know, we often think of it that faith is made up of belief that and trust. So mm-hmm. it's a matter of what you believe, and then you bridge the gaps, perhaps, with trust. And he introduces this idea of a third view of faith. It's about acting as if something is true, and that's what matters. And I guess at the bottom of the first page of that article, he got into something that, as I read it, I thought, I have seen this in the leadership of a congregation. He says here, he says, "Hence we may act on the assumption that there is a God, for unless there is, that which is most worthwhile cannot be had. He will do the same things as the man with Lutheran faith will do. He will, for example, worship and pray and live a good life, partly in the hope to find a better life in the world to come. He prays for his brethren, not necessarily because he believes that there is a God who hears his prayers, but because only if there is can the world be set to right. He lives the good life, not necessarily because he believes that God will reward him, but because only if there is a God who will reward him can he find the deep long-term well-being for which he seeks. He worships not necessarily because he believes that there is a God who deserves worship, but because it is very important to express gratitude for existence if there is a God to whom to be grateful, and there is some chance that there is." I felt like that's more real. That is a place where people are, and that's a place where so much of acting as if something is true formulates how true it is for you. And that's where I found it fascinating that he seemed to be presenting this idea that the actions, they kind of like complete the picture.
Or that actions can be a form of faith. So for instance, the way he defines it, so on the pragmatist view, a man S has faith if he acts on the assumption that there is a God who has the properties which Christians ascribe to him and has provided for man the means of salvation, and so on and so forth. So it's not that he has to actually have the belief cognitively. If he behaves as if it's true, then that's a sort of faith, which is a really interesting way of defining faith.
We've struggled with this aspect of faith in our Christian tradition, and in particular in the Bible, there's this book, the Book of James, where this very issue comes up. And this is one that's bothered a lot of us Reformed folks and caused us problems in Bible studies and discussions on this, where in James chapter 2, verses 14 through 26, is this little argument that basically sums up by saying, so faith without works is also dead. But the kicker in this argument, which I think we don't talk about much, is what it says in the 22nd verse of that Bible passage, which says, "You see that faith was active along with his works, and faith was brought to completion by the works." So there's this notion that faith needs works to complete it, and it's actually part of faith. And I think that that's something that is underemphasized in the faith. We get so caught up on whether or not those works are going to save us or what that means for the judgment of God and all that. But just to understand that basic nature of a human being that says that the actions have to somehow get involved if we're going to complete a belief or a faith. I think that's a really key and fascinating concept. So I did appreciate that, at least out of that article of Swinburne.
Mm-hmm. And it really has some neat resonances for Christian ethics too. Just to pick a question that's definitely on the news and on people's minds as we're recording this here in late November, going with Swinburne's argument here, if someone were to welcome Syrian refugees into their town, into their homes, into their lives, they could do so as if God were going to protect them from any kind of harm. And honestly, this is the tack that a lot of folks in my circles have used to talk about the question of bringing in refugees from any sort of dangerous environment, is that the character of faith, like Rob was just saying, is to live as if God is going to protect you, even if you're honest in your gut, you really aren't quite sure, but to act as if God would protect you and to do what is right, irrespective of the anxieties and the fears that might keep you from doing what is good and right. That is the content of faith, according to that tradition within Christian ethics. So that goes to, you know, questions of war and peace. It goes to questions of generosity and scarcity. A lot of, like I said, theological ethics more generally kind of runs with this distinction between acting as if and acting according to what you can see that Swinburne lays down here.
I thought it was funny that so Paul Helm, the editor of our volume, feels the need to descend from the literary heavens in the only place in this chapter and publish, you know, every other essay in here is something that was published elsewhere before and was a big deal, but he feels the need to descend just to say, yeah, Swinburne, that's a little messed up what we were just talking about there. And specifically, he's getting at the point, which frankly didn't come in through very clear in the Swinburne selection that we read, true. But that it's as if Swinburne was saying pragmatist faith is actually kind of the best kind of faith because it's voluntary and you can control your actions. And just like the Tertullian thing, it's not that faith is inflicted upon you by evidence.
Right.
It's that you consciously make a leap. And that's actually what is so impressive about it.
Yeah.
Yes. And so Paul Helm says, well, the problem with that, Swinburne, is you're saying you just gave us a book, The Existence of God, that has all these arguments that are supposed to take atheists or the doubting or whatever and convince them. And if they are successfully convinced, they no longer have the opportunity to choose faith because it's been that reason has inflicted it upon them. So you can't make it an extra virtuous thing to have faith that's based on no reasons. And then at the same time, try to give people reasons to believe. Make up your mind.
Right. The more you convince them of God's existence, the less virtuous their faith becomes.
Right.
How very disappointing. Like that was like, you know, like I'm grooving along in these readings and I'm like, man, this is great. This is a great experience. You know, I'm engaging in these different ways. And then I read this Helm one. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's silly. It's just silly. I don't know. Is that bad for
me?
What's
silly?
This whole concept that, like, if your belief gets too good, then it's, like, devalued, you know, if it gets too strong.
But he was saying that was Swinburne's position, and he was criticizing it.
So
but
yeah.
I didn't see it in Swinburne in what we read.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a little peculiar that we were getting there.
I think Douglas Adams did this work better with the Babelfish episode in the Hitchhiker novels, you know. Because the Babelfish exists, there must have been a God who intentionally gave it to us. But to believe in God is a matter of faith, not of logic, and therefore God disappears. It seems like, I mean, that's basically the work that Helm was trying to do there.
I just thought the way he tried to capture that just came off sounding silly. So yeah, I guess if we want to give Swinburne the credit for the silliness, then fine. But I was like, oh, let's move on to the next article.
Yeah.
I do think it's interesting, the whole idea of, which was not touched elsewhere in these readings, of is faith voluntary? Is belief, actually Plantinga touches on this, I think just to reject it, but the idea that, I forget the way that he put it, was pretty much that you can't control what beliefs are properly basic to you. And so saying, the way Nietzsche puts this, that we often quote on this podcast, is come on, have an intellectual conscience. So having a normative account of reasonableness, which is sort of the premise for this whole discussion, is being religious reasonable? Well, that means you're looking to a norm of what counts as reasonable. And if you're not doing that, come on, get it together. Change your mind. But according to Plantinga here, no, we can't actually control that. We find reasonable what we find reasonable. We find epistemologically basic what we happen to find that. And coming along and scolding me for believing in God, or it seems like this would apply equally well to not believing in God, is just a little beside the point. You can't control what you believe. I mean, what did you guys think of that? Because that flies right in the face of what Swinburne is saying here, that, or, you know, it's not even, who cares about what Swinburne specifically believes, but just the very common thing that, of course, belief is a matter of a conscious leap, or at least to make it Aristotelian, okay, maybe you can't just decide to believe right now or decide to not believe, but you could develop the appropriate epistemological habits in yourself to either put yourself in a position where you can accept God or put yourself in a position where you will see that God is a unreasonable thing.
Who are you characterizing here? Plantinga?
I thought Plantinga, I mean, I'm kind of combining a few things, but I'm just asking what you guys think about this whole voluntariness.
You mean the idea of behaving a certain way first in order to...
No, the idea of can you control what you believe?
Oh, I see.
The leap of faith.
Yeah, I think what it is that from our perspective, it sure can feel like it. And I think that the circumstances that we put ourselves into and the purposeful actions that we take are certainly ingredients in that. But the ultimate sealing of the deal, so to speak, comes through something which seems to be beyond our control. So again, I'm getting a little Augustinian here, but this idea that, like, yeah, you can do all these actions and put yourself in the right position, and this does move you along the path, get you to the doorway, but what's going to get you across that threshold is a movement outside of yourself.
You could just say grace. It's fine.
Thank you. I was trying not to. I'm trying really hard.
But what would the atheist equivalent be then? That if you're saying, hey, believers, you should get something like Clifford's rule. You should have more of an intellectual conscience. And I know you can't just rid yourself of this belief in God that, like Plantinga, you find you see God in every flower and every pitiful child. But, you know, you could open yourself. You could try to think more scientifically on a daily basis. And then eventually the grace of Dawkins will come into you and allow you to finally...
Yeah, it can't go the other way, because what you're attributing this gifting of grace to is a divine, you know, on the, from the other argument on what moves a person into faith is a divine movement. It's an outside influence, an inner grace that's worked upon you. So going in the other direction, let's assume that the atheist view is correct. And so you're making this appeal. You could get the believer, the theist, to act as if they do not believe. Lord knows we've had those weekends. And then you go along the path. And then at some point, you, just as I cannot will into the person who's in my congregation, all right, now, Shazam, get the spirit now. I mean, I can't do that. Just by the same notion, I think that there's nothing that the atheist could do to the theist to Shazam in the moment in the opposite direction. And in particular, the one is based on the idea of a divine intruder into our hearts. And the other is in abandoning of some notion or belief. So I don't think there's a direct equivalent, but I can kind of appreciate at least there's an equivalent in the approach between the two that you could take.
Mm-hmm. There's also an ambiguity in the term faith within Christian theology, no matter what language you're saying it in, whether you're using the Greek term or the Latin, in that faith certainly can refer to the intellectual content of what somebody would say to be true if you asked them what was true. It also has the connotation, though, of faithfulness or action that is in accord with the contours of this particular story rather than that particular story. And so in that sense, I think that you can talk about faith as a virtue. And in fact, you know, the New Testament does so. I mean, you know, very often Jesus will say, you know, I've never seen such faithfulness in all of Israel when he's talking to the centurion. Or Hebrews chapter 11 will talk about certain orders of life that are faithful lives because they are ordered such that they are pointed towards a world that does not exist as visible yet. So again, what occurs to me is that there is an ambiguity in the term, and therefore there's another dimension to what you're talking about when you talk about faith within Christian theology that might not always be on the table in these conversations, as, for instance, Alvin Plantinga talks about it. If faith is exclusively the tendency to say that this is the case in the world rather than that is the case in the world, that can be entirely involuntary. But to order one's life in accordance to this confession rather than that confession strikes me as almost entirely voluntary.
Well, and I think, yeah, Swinburne has given us the Aristotelian recipe in this description of pragmatic faith where, you know, he says that it's very easy to slip into doctrine then. Once you start acting as if, then like you've bought Pascal's wager, you think, I better act like I believe. I better believe. Yes, you can't directly make yourself believe, but going through the motions does actually get your head in the right spot. So that would be the case, even if you don't think that you jump from being religious generally to atheist or something in this way. There are certainly a lot of cases where somebody is been brainwashed by a cult or something, and you need to get them back to reality. You don't want to just say, oh, now it just seems natural. They've been kidnapped by the Great Pumpkin cult. And so they see Great Pumpkins everywhere. And it's all the, you know, surely there must be some way that we can reasonably say there's a direction toward rationality from that position and have a behavioral program, maybe with some medication on top of that to bend them toward that eventually is something that they will. You see this in all sorts of things, you know, coming to believe that you don't need the alcohol or drugs or whatever. You know, of course, you don't just choose to not be psychologically addicted to such and such, but there's a systematic ambiguity in the role that will plays in these sorts of self changes, that behavior and will are very tightly connected.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that for most people of faith, the question of will and behavior doesn't really come into play when we're talking about does God exist, but it does come into, well, what am I going to do in response to that? The biblical notion of faith is not belief in existence, that when the Bible says believe or faith, it's trust. It's believing in God, not believing that God exists. I have a charismatic buddy of mine who went back in the last town where I pastored before this one. you know, he sat me down one time and he goes, "Oh, goodness, Rob." He says, "Even the devil believes that God exists. The trick is believing in God and trusting that God. But the trick isn't, for most people of faith, believing whether or not God exists. The trick is figuring out what you're going to do with that."
Mm-hmm.
That's why some of these arguments that came up before with from Khan and that says, it almost feels like we're talking about the wrong problem. You know, when you come at it from a perspective of faith and a narrative of faith, you can't help but feel like we're talking about the wrong question. But I mean, personally, I like forcing the question. I like talking about it. I like exploring it. But it does make it difficult when we try to blend in experience, because experience does not in any way intersect with these philosophical proofs of existence or non-existence of God.
Right. And I would qualify that just a bit to say it does come into some kind of relationship, just not as decisively as sometimes folks think it might.
Thank you. Yes, I agree.
So it seems like the common theme here, and I know, Nathan, you are explicitly of a postmodern bent.
Yes, yes.
But is this, you know, we keep coming back to the hermeneutic circle and the logic that you were just talking about, Rob, of it's not a matter of believing that, but believing in, of trust. But of course, unless you're already a member of that community, that doesn't make any sense. So it's kind of circular logic by saying you can't convince an atheist to say, come on, trust. I mean, you could niggle at them and say, come on, you've read the Bible. You know that God is actually speaking to you and you might deny it, but that's just your sin talking. Come on, pay attention to that little voice in you that realizes that you're just actually just being afraid of all the, you know, the rigorous moral changes you would have to make in yourself, or giving up. Which article is this? That's
Adams.
You'd have to be Adams. You'd have to give up control. Robert M. Adams, The Sin of Unbelief, 1987. That you'd have to give up control. I mean, this is why Nietzsche is seen as the father of postmodernism. And religious thinkers have taken Nietzsche and turned it against what Nietzsche actually believed, that he wanted to use this to say, isn't this sort of sick how somebody like Augustine especially uses this to just flail himself and, you know, looking at who's the famous saint that just was famous for whipping himself? Or is that describes 400 different saints?
I was going to say, that sounds like a 14th century flagellant.
Yeah, it's almost that, according to Nietzsche, you can't argue people out of this. You just have to argue that what they're doing is unhealthy. How do you argue that? Well, because somehow you have to believe that the idea of health is built into a person in some way, and it might be corrupted, and some people might, you know, they're so steeped in their twisted way of thinking that they can't get out of it, but hopefully we can feed them enough and treat them with respect or whatever it is that you have to do to get them feeling good and confident and not letting themselves be bossed around by tradition or whatever, and getting them in touch with their natural teleology. That exact same argument is used by somebody like Adams. You know, anybody that says, no, our natural condition is, as Calvin says, as many people say, is of sin. And so you can't expect that. In fact, all this Enlightenment stuff, all this Dawkinsy stuff is twisted in that same way. It's just this fear. And it just seems it's a recipe, this postmodern view, whether it's Nietzsche doing it, and I'm not being entirely fair to Nietzsche here, but, or Plantinga doing it, it does not make for constructive discussion. I guess maybe it can be constructive in we can agree to disagree. Is that where we're left with a postmodern view?
Well, let me propose something a little bit more optimistic than that. I think that if we take not only Nietzsche seriously, but also Westfall seriously, that not only are we limited and finite, but also we have active ideologies that distort the reality that we should be seeing, then it becomes even more important for us to rely on our neighbors, irrespective of their faith traditions, irrespective of their confessions, precisely because we all have that original sin bouncing around, to correct us, to be the voice that tells us what we don't want to hear. And so, I mean, that doesn't make it any less complex, but it does at least open up the possibility that your neighbor can be a gift to you. So I'm going to go ahead and say grace, Rob, and say that for someone convinced by Westfall, the atheist neighbor can be the best gift that God gives to us, because that person might smash an idol that we thought was God and free us up to see something that has a better probability of being truer to God. Or at least that's what I tell my students.
No, absolutely. There's not this magic of formula or words that could push faith into someone. So the idea is that we just witness to the reality that we experience as people of faith. And we believe that there is this act of grace that would move someone into belief, but not any magic formula or thing that we could say. It just is not the same kind of argument both ways. And that's where it makes it difficult to interact here. But I do affirm definitely what you're saying is that as we interact with people, not just of no faith, but as we interact with people of undecided faith or a very different faith, it sharpens our own arguments, our thoughts on what we believe. And it does allow us to smash those idols because we are so very fond of creating a God that is in our image that we spend very little time considering how we might be created in that image.
Mm-hmm. And incidentally, this is why I love teaching Karl Marx and Friedrich Nietzsche and the really powerful atheist writers to evangelical students. It's not an attack on their faith, but it is flowing from my own theological convictions that idolatry is at least as dangerous as atheism is, and probably more so.
And I'll refer folks to our Ricoeur episode that was right after Gadamer that connects the dots between hermeneutics, the hermeneutic circle, and reading the Bible, at least. He gets us into this. Although I think if your name as Westfall is, if your first name is Merold, you have some problems that theology needs to be there to address. Just to be all ad hominem to sort of wrap this up, I guess let's give some closings. As Rob keeps bringing up humility here, my thought in reading this from the beginning was some of it is just, who wants to be the best Socrates? How do you interpret the Socratic doctrine, the Socratic command to undermine things that you just received from tradition, to actually think for yourself? And one of the ways that a lot of people have followed, certainly the way Augustine reads Plato, is we can know enough to know that there's something like a God or the highest good, but then from there we are humble. So I pointed this out when we had read Montaigne, right? Montaigne is known as a skeptic, but he's not an atheist. He's not an agnostic skeptic. He is a humble skeptic, a humble theist, in just the way Rob has been describing, of somebody that is just, our reason is finite, and so we got to accept we can't say anything sensible about it, but pointing at God as indefinitely just something greater than ourselves is a very reasonable thing. It's just, why would you be so arrogant to think that you are the thing that can figure everything out? And so that's one way of being a descendant of Socrates. But clearly the critics of theism think that they're also being good descendants of Socrates, of religion itself is the thing that we've inherited that we need to get rid of. And the reasonable course is either to withhold judgment or maybe following the advice of Flew, who, again, Flew is just saying, yeah, if evidence comes in, I'll accept it. But by default, I'm going to not go out on a limb. I'm going to go forward with my life as a normal human being with a job and concrete things. There's enough troubles in the world that I have to deal with without taking on some massive theology inherited from people thousands of years ago. I don't need that complication in my life.
Well, I think that if you get stuck on the idea of not wanting to inherit that which has gone before you and that brings freedom, then that's going to mess up all kinds of pieces of your worldview. That is going to invalidate everything except for that which you have some personal experience and perception of. And so I think that becomes a little problematic, but okay, fine. We'll sit down and we'll have a chat and we'll see what we can do for me and others like me to convey to folks what we have experienced and what we have seen and what we have felt and what's constituted our reality as we've experienced God in our lives. And I think that if anything, for me, going through this exercise, these readings, I resisted that idea of putting faith and reason up against one another, but instead saying that both share similar problems. Both seem so heavily dependent upon a singular perspective, and that as each starts to give respect and weight to experiences that were not personal, but experienced by others or seen by others, perceived by others, that we take risk. We take risk that we could be going down a false path. I don't know if that's making sense of it, but all I can say is that, like, I feel like to me, a lot of these arguments bring faith and reason together more than separate it.
Well, I'm going to speak a word specifically to Christians who are listening, because first of all, what you all have just heard over these last 2 hours is an example of hospitality. So Mark and Wes are agnostic atheists, like they self-identified, and yet they have welcomed Rob and myself into their digital home. They have allowed us to be ourselves, and they have...
I even got to say grace one time.
Yes, indeed. And for that reason, on a very basic level, they are teaching us ways to interact with people whose ideas we find dangerous. They might not find me dangerous at all, but I know for a fact that some of my friends would find them dangerous. They have welcomed me in, so also we should welcome folks who differ from us. Now, with that said, I think that, once again, the great value of these kinds of exchanges from the Christian side, and I'm going to, you know, take that Rob-flavored humility here and not attempt to speak for what kind of good, if any, these conversations can do for an atheist. But for the Christian, like I said, these conversations stand to loosen up those ideas that we have that might be getting in the way of whatever it is that God might bring to us next. And like I said, you know I'm stacking the deck when I tell the story that way. I am obnoxious enough to think that just about every kind of story stacks that deck, though. So with that, I'll cut the cards and pass it to Wes.
Thanks. Yeah, I didn't realize you found us dangerous.
That's just... Oh, no, I don't personally, no, I but know, my I'm friends certainly would.
His friend Straw Man finds us dangerous.
No, I will say that even though I'm not a believer, I believe in believers. I have often played the role of a defender of religion on this podcast and defender of the idea that faith is not irrational, it's not crazy. And that's part of why I was interested in doing this episode. I think Mark and I are in the same position in the sense that religion really doesn't play any part in our daily lives. I'm not part of any religious community. And a lot of that is just upbringing. I think for Mark and I, it's different reasons. Mark, you grew up with a...
Well, I grew up United Church of Christ, so it was, it was liberal Protestant. They were open-minded enough to let me escape.
Yeah, I would have shut that stuff down. I'll tell you what.
And I actually went to school in Ireland where the public schools are all Catholic. And I believed in God, but I would tell them I wasn't a Catholic, so I didn't have to confess because I was very guilt-ridden. And then when I got to the States, I was a young atheist. Somehow I had a crisis of faith when I was 8 years old, believe it or not. And I was a dogmatic atheist, and I would really argue with my new American friends and try to tell them how crazy they were to believe in God. And then I became interested in philosophy, basically, and I realized that that position was dogmatic and really unfounded. So for me, despite the fact that I don't belong to a religious community and it doesn't play a part in my daily life, I'm sort of enamored of faith without being someone who has it. It's a strange sort of thing. It's like I said, not believing, but believing in believers. And I think the universe is fundamentally mysterious. And I think that God sort of is a way of locating that mystery and being in awe of it. And to that extent, I understand that. That's my closing.
I would have to say that I think both of you, Wes and Mark, would be incredible gifts if you were placed within a community of faith.
This is it. You're listening to it. You're participating in it right now.
I would love.
But what's in it for me, though?
That's all right, all right. Here's the deal. Is it like as an ambassador into that community of faith? I think that in the context of discussions of faith, of understanding how we formulate, hold on to, develop our beliefs, I think that your ability to be gracious and to make space for others to have a very stark difference of belief, but still encourage discourse and hold understanding above conversion would be an incredible gift into a community of faith. So what would you get out of it? Well, I don't know. Maybe there would be that strange warming of the heart that the Methodists like to talk about in conversion. But besides that...
I don't think you'd get the free Zevia that we just got from our advertisers sending us free stuff.
By the way, I have actually gone to church in the last few years, but that was just to meet women. So
okay. All right.
Well, that's the first
step. That is the first step.
And actually, if the sermons were better, I would definitely go.
This Peter von Inwagen essay, which is the larger thing that contains the little bit that we read, it's called Quam Delecta. And the whole first half of it is kind of his faith journey of being an atheist and eventually converting, and describes, just like you were saying, Wes, you know, just how weird it was. He would be no more likely when he was an atheist to think about going to church on a regular basis than he would to take up bookbinding or hang gliding. Just like one of these weird things that other people right. do that you don't really understand why they would put right. the time into that. I thought it was funny. Well, if you're going to be so nice to us, Rob, I will return the gesture to both of you. I knew from listening to Nathan a lot recently that he was going to be right on and very helpful. Rob, since you're not on the other podcast, I hadn't heard you speak so much before. So Rob had approached us like, we want to cross-promote our podcast, so you should have on one of the people from our podcast. And eventually enough time went by, it was going to be whichever host that you were trying to promote at us, whoever has the biggest book that's selling or something that would bring the biggest audience in. And I was just like, well, who actually wants to do it? You're the one that reached out to us. You probably actually listened to our show. Who knows if the other hosts do? So I'm very pleased at your contributions here. And thanks both of you for coming on.
You guys were great. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. I had a blast.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
All right. Next time we are going to talk about Aristotle's De Anima, about teleology in biology. Woohoo! We are supported by your donations. Please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to make a contribution. Big donors since last time have included Ryan Muldoon, Nicholas Komanos, Chen Feng, Billy Vine, Daniel Steffen, Marcus Ashley, John Pwitz, Nancy Thompson, C. Francis Jr., Judy Harris, Brian O'Connell, Todd Mercurial Chapman, Thomas Kearns, Mary Cabell, Tony Williams, Trenton Nall, Anders Leutzen, Stuart Palmer, David Stanton, Lucas Wilson, and David Kling. Thank you to all of you and to the many others who made smaller donations or became $5 members of our member site. It's the equivalent of putting some cash in the hat while we're passing around. And I must remind you to please, please, please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/store to take a look at the 2016 Partially Examined Life wall calendar, my new and best album, songs from the Partially Examined Life, and our new merch options like the Nietzsche mug. One of the songs that does not appear on that album, because I hadn't finished it yet, is the one you're about to hear, which I wanted to point out is my attempt, back from 1994, to set a poem by my wife, whom I had just met. We were just getting out of college, and she had written this poem that was so evocative for me that I immediately ran out and wrote one of the coolest guitar things I've ever written, and a melody to go with it, and it is now, after more than 20 years, finally, fully recorded. It's called Let Us Meet. So extra thanks for Kim for letting me do this. Thank you, everybody, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Let us open our wings in one fluid stroke, with our heads poised just so, and with eyes searching only the empty horizon. Let our stomachs not rebel at the vast space below, without fear, chest pressed out to meet the rising wind. Let us bow our legs to make the muscles hard, and then in one tremendous rush, let us thrive. Clouds, let us screech and call to meet the ragged trees. Let us fold our hands to meet the heavens. Let us close our eyes to meet the ground. let us screech and call to meet the ragged trees. Let us fold our hands to meet the heavens. Let us open our wings to meet the hazy clouds. Let us close our eyes to meet the ground. Let us